Please join me in welcoming Michelle Bullock. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Innes, and lovely to see you all here. I'd like to thank Australian Industry Group for the invitation to speak here today, and it's great to be in Newcastle, and it's great to be here with that fabulous view, so I won't hold it against you if you do get distracted. In recent times, my colleagues and I, we've spent a lot of time talking about the current bout of inflation in Australia and globally. And the reason, I think, is very clear why inflation is too high. And the longer this persists, the more damaging it becomes. It is in all our interests to bring inflation down, and the Reserve Bank Board has been increasing the cash rate to achieve this. But just because our inflation objective has been in focus recently, it doesn't mean that the other part of our mandate, maintaining full employment, has become any less important. Full employment is, and always has been, one of our two main objectives. So when discussing full employment in the context of a central bank's mandate, economists typically talk about something called the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. It's a big mouthful, isn't it? The NIRU, you often heard it called. Now, I'm going to come back to this concept, but just really more generally, full employment means that people who want a job can find one without having to search too long to get one. Now, as I'll emphasise later, the number of hours that people work, that they can actually secure to work, that's also important in defining full employment, but I'll come back to that. I think it's really hard to overstate the importance of achieving full employment. When someone can't find work or the number of hours work they want, they will suffer financially. But the costs of unemployment and underemployment extend well beyond financial impacts. Work provides people with a sense of dignity and purpose. Unemployment, and particularly long-term unemployment, can be detrimental to a person's mental and physical health. The costs of not achieving full employment tend to be borne disproportionately by some groups in the economy: the young, those who are less educated, and people on lower incomes and with less wealth. In fact, for these groups, more disadvantaged groups, improved employment outcomes and opportunities to work more hours are much more important to their living standards than wage increases are. It's getting a job that's important. So in my remarks today, I want to focus on the Reserve Bank's full employment objective and also give an overview of how the labour market has evolved in recent years and months. I'll start by giving an update on current labour market conditions and how we got here. Then I'll discuss how we think about employment in the context of setting monetary policy and how we're striving to preserve many of the gains in Australia's labour market while bringing inflation back down to target. And finally, I'll explain how getting inflation under control within a reasonable time frame will give us the best chance of securing sustainable employment into the future. So first of all, how did we get here? I'll go straight to the graph. Let me take you back to early 2020, when the outbreak of COVID-19 and the resulting public health response led to the sharpest deterioration in labour market conditions in many decades. Hundreds of thousands of Australians lost their jobs. An equally large number were stood down or had their hours cut. This was a time of extreme uncertainty, with a deadly virus threatening people's health and livelihoods, and there were no vaccines in sight. There were credible projections that the unemployment rate would rise to 15%, and our own forecasts at the time, as you can see in this graph, from that time, had unemployment rate remaining high for several years. So it peaked, our forecast had it peaking at about 10%, and then it was still around 6%, in a couple of years later. Many Australians were facing the prospect of a prolonged period of unemployment. So at this time, concerns about labour market scarring were front of mind for policymakers. The sobering experience from previous recessions had taught us that these episodes leave long-lasting marks on individuals, communities, and the economy. There are many forms that this can take. For example, if people stay unemployed for too long, their skills may deteriorate or become obsolete, and their prospects for re-engaging in meaningful work may decline. And this can result in more people in long-term unemployment, or alternatively, people just withdrawing from the workforce. Now, you might recall that monetary and fiscal policy responded quickly to support the community and to reduce the likelihood of this outcome. The size of the policy response was large, and it was designed to ensure against catastrophic economic outcomes, which it did. A particular focus of the fiscal policy response was to keep employees attached to their jobs, even if there was little work for them to do during lockdowns. With the benefit of hindsight, however, some argue that policymakers here and around the world took out too much insurance. Nonetheless, it ultimately allowed us to avoid the long-term scarring effects on employment that had been a hallmark of previous recessions. It's also possible that the particular nature of the pandemic recession, driven by health restrictions and social distancing, allowed for a faster recovery than previous recessions. So the pace and the extent of the recovery has been remarkable, much faster than any previous downturn, and you can see that in this graph here. Labour market outcomes over the past 3 years have consistently exceeded the expectations of the bank and other forecasters. The labour market has proved very resilient. The share of the Australian population in employment has never been higher. The number of Australians in a job has increased by over 1.1 million since 2021, and the level of employment is now almost 8% above its pre-pandemic level. Almost all the gains in employment since the onset of the pandemic have been in full-time employment, as you can see from this next chart. Strong demand for labour has enabled many previously part-time employees to move into full-time work. This has allowed people to move closer to their preferred working hours, pushing the underemployment rate, the underemployment rate captures those looking for more work and those looking to increase their current hours. This underemployment rate is now at levels it's not been seen since 2008. The rate at which people participate in the labour force is also at a record high. The rise in participation since the onset of the pandemic is actually mostly attributable to women entering or re-entering the labour force in large numbers. This has been underpinned by strong labour market conditions, more flexibility in working arrangements, and a continuation of long-run trends of women coming into the workforce. The unemployment rate has fallen sharply, and it's currently a little over 3.5%. Not only did the pace and extent of decline in unemployment surprise forecasters, the improvement since late 2019 has also been large compared with other countries, as you can see in this graph. While this partly reflects Australia having more spare capacity in the labour market than some other countries at the onset of the pandemic, these gains have still been remarkable. So remarkable, in fact, that our judgment is that we're at or perhaps even above estimates of full employment for the first time in decades. And I'm going to come back to why we think this a little bit later. One of the most encouraging things about the strength in employment, this most recent strength, has been how broadly based it's been across the country. It's not been confined to the cities or to individual states or regions. This has meant that the benefits of a strong labour market have been shared amongst many communities. The unemployment rate is at or below 4% in three quarters of all regions, which is what you can see in this graph. Newcastle is in fact a prime example of a region that's undergone a considerable tightening in the labour market. At around 3%, the unemployment rate for Newcastle is now considerably lower than it was prior to the pandemic, and a fair bit lower than the nationwide unemployment rate. That translates to an additional 25,000 residents in this area having work. The messages we hear through the bank's liaison program in the Newcastle area are also consistent with what we are hearing elsewhere in the country. Despite the slowing in economic growth, businesses are facing labour availability constraints stemming from a lack of suitable labour, high levels of job switching, and a shortage of housing. So, as has been the case in previous economic cycles, it's been people on lower incomes and with less education who have benefited most from the strong labour market conditions. The declines in unemployment since the onset of the pandemic have tended to be larger in local labour markets that had weaker labour market conditions to begin with. Labour market outcomes for people without any post-secondary education or training have also improved considerably. The labour market for younger people, whose opportunities for employment tend to decline most during recessions, has also improved much more than the aggregate level. Since late 2019, the decline in the unemployment rate of people aged 15 to 24 years has been more than double the size of the nationwide decline. The fact that the youth labour market recovered so strongly upon the end of the lockdowns helped to alleviate a key concern that policymakers had during the worst of the pandemic. That concern was that there would be a cohort of Australians early in their working life would find themselves permanently at a disadvantage when seeking employment in the future. The tight labour market conditions have also enabled many people who were previously unemployed for long periods to find work. Over 2022, a record number and share of long-term unemployed persons found a job, and fewer exited the labour market as discouraged job seekers, as you can see from this graph here. Furthermore, the tight labour market meant that the risk of becoming long-term unemployed declined significantly. Reflecting these positive developments, the long-term unemployment rate is currently close to its lowest level in decades. In many ways, what we've seen is the opposite of the scarring concern that I discussed earlier. That is, people who would typically have trouble getting to employment have in fact been drawn into work, which is a great thing. It's important to note that not everyone has been able to reap the benefits of a tight labour market. Structurally high unemployment remains a problem in some parts of the country and among some groups, such as our First Nations Australians. These structural issues, which are the focus of Australian Government's employment white paper, are beyond the ability of a monetary policy to address. Monetary policy's primary role in supporting full employment over the longer term is to ensure that inflation remains low and stable. Although, as I've hinted earlier, it may have some impact at the margin if a strong labour market permanently lowers the unemployment rate that we typically associate with full employment. So in recent months, the balance between labour demand and supply has improved somewhat, as the sharp increase in net arrivals from overseas may have helped to alleviate shortages in some areas, and labour demand has moderated as the post-pandemic recovery has run its course. The significant tightening in monetary policy over the past year has played a role in this, as intended. This moderation in labour demand can be seen in a range of indicators, such as job advertisements and employment intentions, as you can see in this graph here. The unemployment rate has also bottomed out, and there are signs that turnover is declining and labour shortages in some areas are easing. Nevertheless, the labour market remains tight, with many firms still finding it challenging to hire workers, and there are still roughly as many vacancies as there are unemployed people. So how do we think about full employment in the context of setting monetary policy? I noted at the beginning that, simply put, full employment means that people are able to find a job without having to search for too long. This doesn't mean an unemployment rate of zero. There will always be frictions in the labour market that mean it takes time to find a suitable job, including because the skills required do not match the candidates available, or there's structural impediments to employment. These issues are best addressed by government policies. For monetary policy, our price stability mandate requires a narrower concept of full employment. We think of full employment as the point at which there's a balance between demand and supply in the labour market and in the market for goods and services, with inflation at the inflation target. This is the level of employment that's sustainable with our price stability mandate in the longer term. Deviations from full employment have implications for price and wage growth. When labour demand outstrips supply, as we've seen, there will be upward pressure on wages growth and inflation. And you can see that in this chart here. On the other hand, when there's not enough demand, there is spare capacity in the labour market, and there'll be downward pressure on wages growth and inflation. For this reason, our objectives of price stability and full employment are usually closely intertwined. A key challenge, though, that we face is that full employment isn't directly observable. We need to infer how close we are to full employment based on things we can observe. And one way of thinking about this is what I talked about earlier, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, the NIRU. The idea is that there's a short-run trade-off between inflation and unemployment. At lower levels of unemployment, wage and price pressures rise, and at higher levels of unemployment, wage and price pressures are lower. But if unemployment remains too low for too long, inflation expectations will rise, which will make it harder for monetary policy authorities to bring inflation back down. Hence the concept that there's an unemployment rate at which inflation is neither rising nor falling. That's the NIRU. But while the NIRU is an important concept to think about this, it's only one of the ways we assess whether we are meeting our full employment objective. Because we can't observe the NIRU, or full employment more generally, we use statistical models to infer how much spare capacity is in the labour market, and at any point in time, based on the signals we're getting from indicators like the unemployment rate, wages and inflation. These models only give a rough guide, and there's substantial uncertainty among the estimates they produce. They also don't account for the full array of supply shocks that can drive a wedge in the relationship between inflation and the labour market, such as what we saw during the pandemic. There's an added complication in that full employment is a moving target. It changes over time as the structure of the economy and the labour market evolves. Aside from statistical models, we consider a broad range of indicators of conditions in the labour market. One of the most important of these is what I mentioned earlier, the underemployment rate. The underemployment rate has grown in importance as a measure of spare capacity in the labour market over time, and it plays an increasingly significant role in our assessment of full employment. The recent experience of the rapidly tightening labour market has also demonstrated the importance of other measures of labour market tightness, such as the number of job vacancies relative to job seekers and the share of workers who choose to switch jobs. And a number of those indicators you can see on this slide here, and you can see that they're all quite strong. Our assessment is that for the first time in decades, firms' demand for labour exceeds the amount of labour that people are willing and able to supply. That is, employment is above what we would consider to be consistent with our inflation target. At the same time, with demand for goods and services high relative to the economy's capacity to supply them, inflation is well above the 2 to 3% target range. As the bank has highlighted frequently over the past year, high inflation makes life difficult for people and it damages the functioning of the economy. It erodes the value of savings, it hurts family budgets, it makes it harder for businesses to plan and invest, and it worsens income inequality. That's why the board has been increasing the cash rate. Now, one of the channels through which higher interest rates work to bring down inflation is by reducing the demand for goods and services, and hence overall demand for labour. There are other channels as well, but this channel is important. What this means is that the labour market conditions will invariably soften as inflation is contained. Now, some may hear this and think the Reserve Bank is prioritising its inflation objective ahead of its employment objective. It is true to say we're resolute in returning inflation to target, but this does not mean that employment has taken a back seat. I think there's two very important points to make here. The first is that the board has been willing to accept a somewhat more gradual return to inflation to target than many other central banks around the world. A faster return of inflation to target would likely mean more job losses in the short term. Our judgment is that if we can return inflation to target in a reasonable time frame, while preserving as many of the employment gains as we can, that would be a better outcome. Indeed, our most recent forecasts have inflation returning to target by mid-2025, while employment growth slows, but it doesn't contract. The unemployment rate is expected to rise to 4.5% by late 2024, as you can see in this chart. 4.5% is higher than the current rate, but this outcome would still leave us below where it was pre-pandemic and not far off some estimates of where the NAIRU might currently be. In other words, the economy would be closer to a sustainable balance point. Of course, these forecasts are subject to a considerable amount of uncertainty. We don't have a crystal ball. There will be developments in the future that none of us foresee. I think that's one lesson we've all taken away from the past few years. The second point I wanted to make is that we need to think about the consequences for the labour market of not getting inflation under control. Price stability is a prerequisite for a strong economy and full employment. Indeed, it's very difficult to sustain full employment without price stability. If high inflation were to become entrenched in people's expectations, it would be very costly to reduce later, involving even higher interest rates and a larger rise in unemployment. A deep, long-lasting recession would be likely, which would mean a substantial rise in the unemployment rate. Our goal is to return the labour market and the market for goods and services back to a level more consistent with full employment, something like the endpoint in our forecasts in this chart. We think this can be achieved if employment and the economy more generally grow at a below-trend pace for a while. This would help to bring demand and supply into better balance and give us the greatest chance of securing sustainable employment into the future. So I want to thank you for your time, and I'm very happy to take your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. I'm going to open it up to questions. I've got a couple of questions that have been prepared in advance, have been asked in advance, but please, if you do have a question, put your hand up. We've got a couple of microphones to go around the room, so please speak into the microphone because this session is being recorded, so for obvious reasons, for the record. So your questions are important to get as well as the answers. Michelle, can I just ask the first question? A lot of businesses in this room and around Australia, as I mentioned, and you acknowledge, are finding it incredibly difficult to find staff. You talked about holding on to staff, but to find staff in the first place. Does the bank, and you talked about the increased jobs in the Newcastle area, around 25,000, does the bank have a view around how those staff shortages, which in turn will impact, hopefully, potentially positively on productivity, how those staff shortages can be alleviated, or is it really a productivity issue that businesses are facing at the moment?
Is
it
on?
Nope.
No? It's on now? Okay, great, thanks. So I think a couple of things. Firstly, migration has assisted to some extent in the sense that there were shortages in some areas for which particularly students and backpackers have alleviated some shortages. I'm thinking hospitality, I'm thinking agriculture, those sorts of areas where they were struggling to find staff, and these were the people that typically did this sort of work. And I think that the net migration has helped that. The challenge with this, of course, is that net migration brings with it more demand. These people need to find somewhere to live, they need to eat, they need to send their children to school if they're families and so on. So it's not, migration isn't the solution to filling these roles. I think where we would see the issue, and I highlighted in my graphs, is that we're at a point where those that are unemployed don't fit the skill set and the needs of where the roles are at the moment. And that's what's indicating to us that we're above full employment. In those circumstances, the way that works itself out, if it doesn't get resolved by perhaps reducing demand for labour, is it works out in wage rises and it works out in churn, which is not good for businesses either. So My answer to the question really is that we need to slow demand for goods and services, slow demand for labour a bit, and that ultimately is what's going to bring things back into balance. Having said that, to your point on productivity, one of the things that often happens when labour is expensive and it's hard to get is that businesses are incentivised, if you like, to look for labour saving things. So investing in labour saving, automation, those sorts of things. I don't know if I've seen much of that, and maybe some of you have already, as businesses, have already thought something about that. But that's typically one response that you would see in these circumstances, and it might be something that we start to see flow through in the future.
It's certainly more and more part of conversations. Before I go to the floor, I'll just ask a question from Brian Beasley at Campbell Engineering. I think the question a lot of people have is, other than changes in the prime interest rate, what other tools, if any, does the Reserve Bank have at its disposal to control inflation?
So this question does get asked a lot lately, and I know people are interested. The bottom line is none. We only have the interest rate. It is a challenge, and we acknowledge that rising interest rates does affect certain parts, certain people, certain groups of the economy more than others. There's a number of channels through which rising interest rates can slow demand. One is the one that most people focus on, which is the cash flow channel, which is that people who have borrowings have less cash flow because they're paying higher interest rates. But that's not the only channel. As interest rates rise, people are incentivised to save more rather than consume, and that reduces demand. It also keeps the interest rate a bit higher, which means that imported inflation is lower. So it is our only tool. It works through a number of different mechanisms, but we really, in bringing down inflation, that's the only tool we have.
We'll go to Wally first, just here. There's a microphone just coming to you.
Yes, good afternoon. Wally Kugich from Brickworks. One of the things that we're looking in our business is a slowdown occurring in the construction site. On top of that, we have interest rates going up, so people aren't going and buying homes. We have energy going up. We've now been told it's going to be 25% to 30% increase in domestic energy, and then you've got commercial. Then you've got, on top of that, a potential breakout of wages. The CMFMU have said they're going to be looking at 5 to 6%, maybe more at the end of the year. What can government do? I mean, you're the RBA. How can you advise government? There must be things that government can do to slow this down a bit, because we're going to come to an edge where, are we going to end up like in New Zealand, a recession, or hopefully like the US with an inflation rate of 4%?
Yes, another question that gets asked a lot, what can the government do? And look, I can't advise the government. I can only talk really about monetary policy. But I think the government are trying to do what they can. I think they have made some moves in terms of some subsidies that will help to bring inflation down a little bit, which will help to contain inflation expectations, I hope. The most recent budget was broadly neutral. It's not adding to inflation. So I think there are things that the government can do, and I think things the state governments can do as well. So it's going to be important that the governments focus on not adding too much to aggregate demand, and where they can, we hope that inflation and not let wages increases get too far ahead of ourselves, because wages haven't been a contributor to inflation really yet, but there is a risk that if inflation expectations get ingrained and wages respond to that and wage demands respond to that, that we end up in a situation where inflation is very difficult to get down.
Thank you. I have a question here from Sam, who I think is there. Sam sits on the board of one of Australia's largest mutual banks, headquartered here in the Hunter, and she's interested in the payment system and how the growing, and you being ex-payments, how the growing number of technology companies such as Apple, Google, Afterpay and Zip with digital wallets, how would a new governance regime impact them, and any thoughts around those new payment systems?
So this is a really interesting question. Payments has gone from being the plumbing of the system to everyone's interested in it all of a sudden. And looking out at businesses around the tables here, payments actually, and the cost of payments is actually really important. What we've observed over time is that we've gone from a situation where basically payments was the purview of the banks, and they had merchant customers and consumers. And now there's all sorts of organisations involved in the payments chain. And the mention of some of the large big techs in this is an important one. The reason I think this is important is that they're all taking a clip. And if they all take a clip, that puts costs up to merchants typically. And the Reserve Bank's focus over the last few years has been trying to put downward pressure on payment costs for merchants. How are they going to take to this new... So we've got some, for those of you who aren't aware, we've got some new legislation coming in that would give us the power to regulate other participants in the payments chain that we currently don't have. And how are they going to take to that? I think they're going to be not very happy. Our focus is and remains on making sure that we can keep payment costs low for merchants. And that's going to involve making sure that competition is working in that market. And so I'm glad we've got those powers, and I think it's going to be very important for the next few years.
Way over there. And I think there was one there. I think, yeah, I've got you.
Thank you. Bob Hawes from Business Hunter. Just to bring it down to a Hunter level just for a sec, if that's all right. And picking up on your comments earlier about the employment and how it has changed significantly. Here in the Hunter at the moment, we've got about 7,000 jobs out there on the Internet Vacancy Index. There's about 10,000 in the pool of unemployed across the region on the ABS statistics. And there's about 23,000 that are on the Jobs and Skills Australia, that's their new name, isn't it? List, which are people that are getting a benefit, and many of which are actually not working hours to qualify for a full-time job, so they do get a benefit. Given the tight situation, I'm interested in what the Reserve Bank does in looking into the jobs and skills list to see what matching we can do and what options there are, and what advice you might give to government to unlock that pool, which is obviously far greater than the people that are only working an hour or less a week, to be able to relieve the situation that we have currently across many regions in Australia.
Yes. So, again, back to my original point, we've got one tool, and that's the interest rate. And the way that works is that if it can't be addressed by other means, then it works by ultimately slowing demand for labour, and that's the way the whole thing resolves. Having said that, the government are doing work in this area. They've got the employment white paper coming out. What you've highlighted is what we refer to as structural unemployment. The unemployed don't have the skills that fit the vacancies that are going. And what that says to you is that there needs to be a training gap somewhere along the line. So the government's employment white paper, I think, is going to be very important in this context, because this is going to be basically about policies to give people the right skills to meet these vacancies. I should add that this is not only a short-term issue, but it's a longer-term issue, because the economy structure changes over time, and the skills that we all need and people need are going to change over time. So this isn't just sort of a one-off, we've got to fix this problem now. We've got to have policies that take us into the future and make sure that we are educating and skilling people up to meet the challenges of what's coming in 10 years' time in terms of all the different industries and skills that will be needed. So the government is, we're very positive about the government doing work in this area, and I know that they're working very hard on their employment white paper.
Just a question here. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Matt Johnson from Coolabah Capital. Thank you very much for your speech today. I noticed the charts that you had thinking about the dual mandate. Would it be fair to say that you're sort of over-clubbing it maybe on the employment side and maybe under-clubbing it on the inflation side? And with that in mind, during the speech you'd mentioned that if the unemployment rate stays too low for too long, that inflation expectations could get away. So I wonder if that's maybe what's going on at the moment. Inflation expectations are getting away, and if there's a risk that maybe you need to take the unemployment rate back to where it was pre-pandemic, more like 5.5 rather than 4.5, to get things under control.
Well, we hope that's not the case, and we're not aiming for that. A couple of things, points to make, I suppose. The labour market is lagging. We do know it lags. So, and we do know that consumption has come off quite a lot. So the question is it just a matter of time before the labour market starts to ease off? Or, as you are suggesting, we just haven't put interest rates up high enough yet. I mentioned in my speech that we are aiming to bring inflation back to target with a slightly longer period than other countries overseas, and in many ways it might be much easier just to jack up interest rates, because interest rates overseas, official cash rates equivalent overseas, are higher than they are here in Australia. So we are hoping that we can bring inflation down a bit more gradually, keep inflation expectations anchored, and keep at least the unemployment rate will have to rise, but hopefully not. We think actually it was probably the unemployment rate was above the NAIRU before the pandemic. We think there was lots of evidence that suggested that it could come lower. 4.5 probably looks, we think, you know, maybe in the ballpark. So yes, that's an issue that we're worried about. And the risks on the upside that we don't clamp down inflation soon enough. Having said that, the indicators we look at in terms of inflation expectations, short-term and long-term expectations, at the moment still remain pretty anchored. But we'll be watching those very, very closely in terms of our next thoughts on our next decisions.
Michelle, we're going way over to the back corner.
Okay. I'm a mere resident of Newcastle, and I wonder, there's some talk that there'll be more interest rises fairly quickly, but then we've had a gentleman in the room down here talking about the costs of power, etc., that are actually exponential, and also we're having some big corporations that have actually left this town in our major shopping centres. And I'm just wondering, to put the interest rates up too quickly now, wouldn't you do a bit of wait and see? Because we're actually having a big steer away into sort of renewable energies pretty quickly, especially on our port here. And our skills base isn't, as you've said here, are another issue. There's a lot of other things into play. And I have no idea about how the Reserve Bank sees its philosophy or the economic understanding, and you're an economic an honest student, which is amazing. But I think, wouldn't you just hold off a while and see what happens in the next 6 months rather than gear into further interest rises, so that you see how the power prices play out, how the lack of skills and lack of training play out a bit. But then the renewable energies are going through the central west and also around Young and Yass in a big way. That's a lot of heavy lifting happening too. Wouldn't some of this balance out a bit more? Because I think it's a bit frightening that the only tool we still have in the first world is interest rates. The world is shifted, and okay. I think observation might help.
What do you think?
I guess I'd make the point that we are data-driven. We are looking at what's going on. We're not being bloody-minded in any sense. I think we are watching what's going on. We are trying to forecast as well. And forecasts aren't perfect, but we've got to do them because we've got to have an idea of where we think we're going. And we are being data-driven. And we do have a business liaison program where we are going around talking to businesses all around the country and getting signal from them on how conditions are going. So That would be my answer, that we're not actually on a preset path. We are basically watching very closely what's going on, and we're using, including liaison, to inform our forecasts and get ourselves onto what we think is the best path of bringing inflation down while trying to maintain employment.
Okay. Any more questions? Oh, there's one right there. The last one.
Since I'm the last one, hello, Michelle.
Hello.
My first job, I'm Councillor Jenny Barry on the City of Newcastle, was at the Reserve Bank of Australia. As a 16-year-old, 9 months person from Woi Woi, who used to travel 2 hours daylight to sunrise, to sunset, I just want to congratulate you. I want to welcome you to Newcastle. You're the first woman on that board, male-dominated, I presume. Will you take the job if offered to you, if your president... if your president is forced out by media or is forced out by whatever, another job offer? As a woman, I'd like to congratulate you, and I'd like you to do some whale watching while you're here. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and no comment.
That was a no comment. Michelle, can I just ask you one last question? Everyone is focused on inflation and, to put it bluntly, wondering when the cash rate rises will end. I'm not asking you to say when will they end, because that's like asking you to punt on currency as well. But what are the sort of signs that you're looking for that perhaps things are moderating, if they're not moderating already?
So the things that we highlight that we are continuing to focus on are obviously inflation, and particularly services inflation, because we are observing goods prices inflation coming down, but we're still seeing quite sticky services inflation, and that's actually something that's happening overseas as well. This isn't just us. So we'll be watching that. We'll be watching the employment market. We'll be watching consumption quite closely. And one of the big things that is occupying our minds is how are households responding with their very large savings buffers that they have built up. During the pandemic, Australians on average, not all households, but on average, Australians built up a massive buffer of savings. They couldn't spend it. They spent what they could on goods, and then they couldn't spend anything going out or going on holidays, so they just saved it all. Million-dollar question is, what do they do with it? Do they spend it? Or do they decide, well, no, I'll sit on that now and I'll just use it as a bit of a buffer for future? So that's another thing we're watching. We're obviously watching what's going on overseas as well, quite closely, because we are tending to follow a little bit what's happening overseas and what's going on in other countries in terms of inflation. And finally, what's going on in China, because China is very important to the Australian economy. And there's signs there that China's slowed a little bit, perhaps. So that might be something to watch as well. So there are sort of a range of factors that we're focusing on in deciding how to go.
Michelle, thank you for that. It was really good to see you. Hopefully you do see some whales. But I'd like to ask Craig O'Loughlin from Australian Super. I sit on the board of Australian Super, a great privilege to do so, just to give a quick vote of thanks. Craig.
Thank you. Thanks, Innes. Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Michelle, amazing presentation, very insightful. Thank you. The Q&A is always tough. You never know what you're going to get. You did a wonderful job, so thank you for making the effort to travel from Sydney and make sure you drive home safe this afternoon. I know you've got to head off shortly. Australian Super and the AI Group partner a number of events like these. And it's really about coming together, sharing of information, opening the dialogue.